Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Ryan Cooper, national correspondent at The Week, joins me to discuss his piece, How Democrats Learned to Stop Worrying and Hand Out Fat Stacks of Cash, because it seems the Democratic Party may have actually learned a lesson.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey, become a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. It is your support that helps keep this show going. And don't forget, you can watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/Sam Cedar, S-A-M-S-E-D-E-R. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, her very popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, here we are. It is, we are, you know, obviously now we've hit the year anniversary of the pandemic. In some respects, that's not really the big news. I mean, the big news is this $1.9 trillion pandemic COVID relief bill signed by Joe Biden over the past week. I mean, also passed, obviously, by the Senate and the House. And there's some major sort of elements of the wish list that I think progressives wanted and frankly, the American public wanted in terms of the $15 minimum wage. That's the biggie. Then, you know, the difference between $2,000 and $1,400. And I think that, to me, is more of a political matter because there's a lot of money in this bill for individuals. There's a steep cliff on the drop off for the $1,400 checks from $75,000 to $80,000. But we also have to offset that in terms of number of people who get it. Adult dependents are also getting the $1,400 checks. But a family of four making $50,000 could be looking at $20,000 by the end of this year in terms of like direct government payments. And so without going through, you know, maybe we'll run through some of the elements of this, the increased unemployment numbers, the $300 to $360 per child monthly for families making less than $150,000. I mean, this is for folks like us who have been watching this stuff for, you know, a couple of decades and watching it sort of like casually for many decades. This, in my mind, represents a little bit of a sea change because, well, I mean, give me your take on that, because it really feels different, and there's nothing bad in this bill. Some things I would have liked more, but there's also no, like, we have to give this to corporations to, you know, pay off the right to pay directly to Americans.
That's right. I mean, that in fact, what you just said, I think that's really, you know, one of the things that is most astonishing about this. For one thing, part of it had to do with the way they went about the negotiation. They decided early on, obviously, after having gone through what happened with the Obama stimulus package and then Obamacare, that doing this, you know, long negotiation with Susan Collins and, you know, Mitt Romney or you know, Lisa Murkowski, the so-called moderates, all that did was water down the bill in half the time, and the Republicans really wouldn't vote for it anyway. And it was, they realized that, for one thing, this is an emergency, and it's a gigantic emergency. People can't forget that just because we have the vaccines coming and numbers are coming down from this monstrous surge over the winter. It's not over. And the hangover economically is going to be monumental. They had to do this, and they had to do it now in order to get this thing rolling so that when the economy can open up, that they're going to have things in place that will kind of start to repair the damage. I mean, this isn't just, you know, just open the doors tomorrow and everything's fine again. I mean, this has been a huge, huge disaster. So he had to get it rolling. They decided early on that they weren't going to negotiate, and they didn't negotiate with themselves. I mean, they had a little bit of a back and forth with Joe Manchin and gave him some room to pretend like, you know, he's some kind of maverick or whatever. But, you know, really, what compared to what we've done in the past, it was absolutely very smooth sailing. And as a result, look at, you know, it's just what you say. There isn't a whole lot of these giveaways, these ideas. Well, we have to appease this industry and we've got to, you know, Wall Street's going to be upset if we do this, et cetera, the kind of things that they usually do. And in fact, even the Chamber of Commerce was for this bill, you know, groups like that. We haven't heard a word from the Club for Growth. I mean, since last spring when they actually came out against the first, the CARES Act. So something really has changed. I think that it is a sea change. I mean, part of it is, you and I've discussed this a lot over the past month or so, what's happened to the right and how they're actually not even playing on the economic governance field anymore. They've decided their hope is to, you know, suppress voters, suppress voting, and to run a culture war kind of permanent campaign. So they're not even really involved. They throw out a few excuses and say, oh, it's a giveaway. And then they move back on to Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head. So they're in a different place. And as a result, what we see here, I mean, this is really a great bill. I mean, I am hesitant to say that because, you know, it's like, really, we can do that. But say, you know, compared to what we, I mean, really, it's the biggest anti-poverty bill since the 1960s. And it's also middle class families are going to benefit from this, too. I mean, one of the things that hasn't been mentioned a lot is that they really increased the subsidies for Obamacare. And a lot of people who've been right caught in that squeeze, you know, of making just a little too much money to get help, but not enough money to pay the gigantic premiums on the private market, suddenly, you know, they're going to have some assistance here. That's going to make a big difference to a lot of people. And, you know, there's things like that throughout that, you know, obviously they went to the policy shops on the Democratic side, and the Democrats still have policy shops, which the Republicans have just pretty much given up on. And they went and took their best ideas and they got some good people in there, and they didn't salt it with a bunch of austerians, you know, people going, oh, no, we've got to worry about the deficit. They didn't get those. They left those people out of the argument because they are irrelevant. And as a result, we have a bill that could really make a difference. They're saying it could cut child poverty in half this year. What? I mean, you know, how does that happen? I mean, that's amazing.
Every time I hear that, I feel obligated to say, like, well, why don't we just go cut it
completely? I know. I feel the same way. You're like, well, what do we need to do to make that to go the other 50%?
I mean, so, you know, I want to just make sure that that theme is understood, the undercurrent here is like, well, we're cutting child poverty 50%. Means we figured out what it takes to cut at least half of it. Maybe it would take a little bit more than double that amount to get all of it, because there may be more extreme poverty in those instances. And presumably it is we're dealing with that extreme poverty and hopefully, you know, lifting people up. But in terms of if you look at this within the context of American politics, the idea that a bill like this could have existed, and we should say, the amount of money that is going directly to people is significantly larger than in any of the bills that have preceded this in terms of, I mean, directly to people. And then the money that's not is going to states and cities and towns, which ultimately will provide services for those places or build infrastructure or build, mass transit in instances. So this, there is no money in this bill, nothing significant anyways. There is a support for restaurants, close to $29 billion, I think, so there is some money that's paid to corporations. And by that, like, only a percentage of that is, like, you know, big corporations in terms of these restaurants. But as opposed to, let's say, the CARES Act, where, $500 billion of that was basically a down payment on backstop loans for corporations to buy their own shares back. I mean, there's none of that in this. And when you look back at the stimulus after the 2008 financial crisis, you're talking about $800 billion, half of which were tax cuts. And not particularly, you know, they were targeted, but not targeted. I mean, not refundable tax credits. And, you know, I think you and I would both agree that, like, it's too bad that we have to call it that, as opposed to a $300 a month payment to families who have kids between 6 and 18 years old. I mean, that's real money. That is a huge help. And the fact that it's spread out like that, and we could go on and on. You mentioned the ACA subsidies. No one will pay more than 8.5%, which is not nothing, of your income, but it is 2 or 3% less than it was before. And that's, you know, hundreds of dollars, maybe, you know, even close to thousands of dollars. You know, somewhat equivalent to what we would anticipate paying for a Medicare for All type of situation. Now, that's only, you know, in terms of taxes, not as efficient, still private insurance, maybe co-pays and this and that. So I don't want to overstate it. But in terms of savings and the threshold for where you're available to subsidies is higher. And there's 100% coverage of COBRA if you were employed and you had employer's insurance, that will be taken care of. Completely inefficient way to do it. Much better to expand it with Medicare. But in terms of what Americans get, what I wonder about this, and none of this stuff, sadly, is permanent yet. The child tax credit, refundable tax credit, they want to make it permanent, but it's only for 1 year. But I wonder if your sense is that one of the things that will come out of this, particularly the whole year, and particularly like watching, you know, and including like what's happening with the vaccine, if there will be a change in the way that Americans perceive the role of government in their lives. Because you and I come from a generation where we were told, starting with Reagan, also with Clinton, you know, maybe a little bit less with Obama, but that was still the difference that like government's sort of the problem. And the less government we have and the less government support we have, you know, the more the market rules the day, the better off we'll be. And this is not like that.
It's really not like that. And it's quite interesting to me. I don't think I anticipated this. I don't know about you, but because of the fact that we, you know, grew up in this world where the idea, you know, what's Reagan's famous saying? It's, you know, oh, the worst you know, the words in the English language are the government's coming to help you. You know, I mean, that whole thing. And that just seemed to be, that was so accepted by just about everybody. The conventional wisdom, it was just absolutely a consensus that this was the way it was, that there was nothing you could do about it. And I think that Obama, I don't know whether he believed that, but I know for a fact that he and his people thought there was nothing they could do about it, that they were going to have to appease that one way or the other, which was the sort of framework of his grand bargain. In order to get these things like cap and trade or to get a healthcare program, we're going to have to give them this, that, and the other, cut Social Security, because we got to keep this idea that government is a problem and we, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I think that does seem to be gone. And maybe it's, I think we talked about this once before, that the fact that it's this pandemic, which hit everybody, you know, nobody's untouched by this thing, no matter how rich you are, no matter how poor. Some people got hit much harder for obvious reasons. They're in underserved communities. They're out there working in the front lines. You know, the elderly people got it much harder. You know, I mean, all these things. But nonetheless, there's nobody who hasn't been affected by this. Every single person has dealt with a world that was changed virtually overnight, almost exactly a year ago, 1 year ago. And as a result, where do we look to try and figure out how to deal with this thing? We had no choice. We had to look to government. I mean, where are we going to go? Look to some corporation, go look to Amazon. I mean, you know, there was nothing there. Government was it. And, you know, we saw two things happen. One was on one level, we saw the federal government under Donald Trump and his absolutely, you know, inefficient, you know, unfit form of leadership that he took. We saw how bad that could be. We watched him on television talking about things that made no sense. We watched, you know, and then we watched others. We sort of were dealing with our own governors, you know, in different states and trying to watch that. But what we saw was that we needed government. I think maybe there was a sense that, look, this is, we need this. This is important. And when the CARES Act came out, the first one, and people got money, you know, they went, whoa, you know, this is a whole new thing. And, you know, granted, that was under Donald Trump. But of course, you know, he had nothing to do with it. That was purely a congressional, you know, initiative that was thoroughly bipartisan. And maybe that has happened. Maybe it's the pandemic, this sort of idea. And it's not just national. It's not just your local thing. It's a global thing. And in a weird way, that may sort of set the table for people to start thinking a little bit differently about climate change. I mean, these are things that require you know, a collective response, whether it's in our own neighborhoods and we're trying to deal with how to, you know, I don't know, have a street party or what are you going to do with your kids and, you know, going to school, or whether or not it's the global idea now that we're really starting to have to grapple with is how do we vaccinate the world? Because the virus isn't going away and we can't afford to, you know, we can't build a wall high enough to keep the virus out of our countries. So this, it's sort of, you know, maybe this has opened up a new thing and maybe the idea, you know, the Republicans just left the field because I think they their ideology is useless in this situation. It has nothing to offer whatsoever, or what they call their ideology.
Let's take a break here because I want to talk about, you wrote a great piece about that very topic, about the hollowing out, or maybe, depending on your perspective, maybe just sort of like the veneer rubbing off. And it was, you know, it was pretty hollow to begin with. It just had a veneer that I think had maybe fooled some of the people. But I want to talk more about how we got to this point, because and then ultimately where we're going, because this is, you know, maybe we revert. But in the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Heather Parton. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were basically going over the nature of this COVID-19 relief bill, which passed last week, signed, it's passed over the past couple of weeks, depending on the House and the Senate, and then back to the House, signed by Joe Biden. And this is, it's an extraordinary piece of legislation in that it pays directly to Americans. It is targeted to people living in poverty and to people, you know, broadly speaking, in the working class and in the sort of the middle class, and, you know, but we're hitting about 85% of the country, 85 to 90% of the country in some fashion or another, are getting direct payments in some instances, you know, thousands. Well, in all instances, thousands of dollars. But in some instances, you know, even $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. That in and of itself is extraordinary. The fact that corporations do not get to wet their beak in this bill, also extraordinary, because there was no sort of, you know, protection money that had to be paid, right? You let us do this and we'll take care of you as well. And then it was also sort of extraordinary in the way that it was passed, which was, there was a brief, you know, lip service paid to partisanship, but it was quite clear that everybody was quite serious, that Joe Biden was quite serious, that we're going to do this. We're going to give you, I'm going to invite 10 senators to the White House, and I'm going to have a cup of coffee with them, and I'm going to say, guys, if you got something, I'm all ears. But, you know, 2 days from now, we start the reconciliation process, and that's exactly how it went. And all of those things are extraordinary. Particularly in the context of American politics, you posited that part of this is, you know, I mean, certainly is a function of the nature of this crisis, where it is universal, like literally universal. I mean, I've explained this to my son. I said, you know, there's never been anything that's happened that, like, people in other countries are talking probably about the same thing that we are at the same time, you know, maybe world wars as well. But this is basically hit every remote region of the world, and has other implications in terms of vaccinations and whatnot. But I also wonder if this had hit at a different time, if Joe Biden would have had this response. In other words, like, you know, we were very, in my mind, the idea that Bernie Sanders came so close to winning the Democratic primary in 2016, that there are these movements that have been created, talking to Ryan Grimm about what took place in Nevada, that there has been, and also generational change, I think, where the expectation of what government can do is so huge is so much bigger than it was when we were, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when we were younger folk. And that the context in which this pandemic took place also has a huge bearing. And then simultaneously, what's happening with the Republicans? Like, all of this together, I think, sort of creates this moment.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. I mean, if this had happened 10 years ago, I mean, we had a big crisis. We know what happened. We had a big crisis. We had an extremely popular Democratic president. I mean, Democrats were in love. I mean, it was, Obama was the most popular president in my lifetime on the Democratic side by far. Nobody even comes close. And he came into office and he was facing a terrible crisis, and it was huge, not like this one, but it was huge. And he ran up against, you know, the Democrats' own, you know, shibboleths and the party's own sort of sense of boundaries, a Republican Party that was much more unified ideologically and had a strong sense of their own. You remember, this was Paul Ryan's Republican Party. It's not the same party anymore. I mean, you had people like him and Ayn Rand acolyte who believed in, you know, objectivism and was, you know, sort of extreme libertarianism and laissez-faire economics. It was a very different party then. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that, and let's not forget, I mean, Donald Trump, too, the fact that he was president when this happened, and this was a horrible thing for America, but nonetheless, it sort of shone the light on whether or not you want competency in government. I mean, he was out there trying to sell snake oil. I mean, literally selling hydroxychloroquine and telling people to drink bleach. I mean, this was, you know, he showed in living color why politics and government are not just a little game show, and how important it is that you have people who actually are competent. And I don't mean to say, you know, the meritocracy or, you know, talk about, you know, elites from, you know, elite universities. I'm not saying that at all. I mean, competence it comes in a lot of different flavors. And Donald Trump showed that they had none of them. And as a result, I think that has this moment of Joe Biden. And, you know, we talked about this too before, you know, how Biden is your second favorite kind of politician who goes with the flow. And the flow as presented to him was a flow that was built over a long period of time, as, you know, you mentioned with Bernie Sanders, with the progressive movement, with a lot of dialogue over the last 20 years about economics and how, you know, the necessity for government to take a more activist role. This idea that, you know, the modern monetary theory and the discussions going on around that and whether deficits are real and whether or not they are something to be concerned about, and certainly austerity after what we went through in 2008, you know, from the financial crisis. So it set the table for this moment where, you know, we are in a position now to perhaps, you know, move forward out of that era. And it's a horrible thing to have it happen around a disaster of this scale, but maybe that's what has to happen. I don't even know. Maybe you have to have a disaster to introduce something new. But, you know, I read this piece by Zach Carter, who wrote a book recently about John Maynard Keynes, and it's really, really good. Highly recommend it. And he wrote in the New York Times, they were doing a retrospective on the last year of the virus, and he was talking about this economic shift. And he, of course, you know, he's going, look, you know, this is Keynes. Keynes says, you know, in a disaster of this scale, this is government steps in, you start spending money. That's what you do. But he also says what was exposed in the coronavirus disaster in the United States and in Western Europe too, but for that matter, is the fact that when you starve government of things like public health, when you starve it of infrastructure, when you starve it over and over again of these things, when you come into a disaster like this, you are unprepared, people die, and things start to fall apart. And he said that's the other side of Keynes, which is that is the investment side. And that's what's opening up to us right now, is this idea that, and the COVID relief bill certainly has elements of investment in it. I mean, there are, you know, there's money for infrastructure for schools, there's money for the states and cities, as you pointed out. But, you know, that's just the beginning. And what he sort of is saying, maybe we are now opening into a new era where we're going to start, you know, governing the country in a way that makes it possible as a modern society to deal with these intractable problems of poverty, inequality, all of that, and also is prepared for what's to come, because, you know, the future is going to be here whether we like it or not. And that means climate change. That means more of these pandemics. It means a lot of global challenges that go way beyond just our, you know, sort of picky in politics, and certainly way beyond anything to do with Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head, which is just, you know, infuriating that anybody's even talking about that. But, you know, this is a moment to sort of take the other half of John Maynard Keynes. You get out of the disaster, and that's when you start thinking about how do we make this so that we don't do this again.
That part of it, I mean, you know, I've been saying since Biden got elected, I said, you know, we're going to have a better sense, you know, in March, at least as to, you know, whether Biden is my second favorite type of politician, which is a cipher where it's pushing, you know, and progressives and the left broadly is pushing, and there's some response, you know, a $1.9 trillion bill that is, and of course it's not. He's not Bernie Sanders. There's not a $15 minimum wage. Kamala Harris was not instructed to overrule the advice of the parliamentarian, which President Sanders would have said, forget the parliamentarian. I don't care. So it is what it is in that respect. And then the real question, like you say, is that, which way does the trajectory go here? And, you know, Joe Manchin talking aside, he's been talking throughout this whole thing. I mean, who knows what it's going to take to sort of placate him. But I wonder if there will be a moment, because I remember when this started. Obviously, I think everybody does. But I had read in that March, maybe by, you know, the first, second week of being locked down, we started to read about the 1918 pandemic because to a large extent, completely wiped out of our national memory. In part because of World War II, in part, I can understand it now, too, frankly, you know, having gone through this, if I never have to think about this period again for the rest of my life, I'll be very happy. But if, you know, we lost 500,000, approximately 550,000, if I remember correctly, dead in that pandemic. And if you were to tell me that we would not, that we would have the same outcome, I would have been like, come on, it's 100 years later. Surely we are better prepared as the wealthiest nation in the world, in the history of the world, to deal with this. And we weren't. Now, granted, we had a president who was actively denying the existence of this. Mm-hmm. But we had no method. We still don't have a methodology to support people when they're not going into work. We have a hodgepodge of a medical system that left, specific pockets of low income, very often brown and black people, particularly vulnerable because hospitals have been shut down and whatnot. And I don't get the sense that we have had a reckoning, a national reckoning. Like, we haven't had that conversation. Now, maybe it comes when we're on the other side of this. Or maybe people are just like, whatever distance we can put between what happened, you know, the sort of bacchanalia that I think people are going to have when this is over, the situation. But that's going to be very telling as to whether, when we get to this infrastructure bill, if there is this sense of like, look, we need to build some resiliency in our system.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the table, despite the fact that Democrats only have 50 votes in that Senate, the table couldn't be sort of set better, because 50 in some respects is better than 54. Right? I mean, 61 would be great, but 50 means that, like, you know, everybody knows we're not going to get 11 Republicans on board for anything, or 10 Republicans on board. So, like, why try? And the reality is out there. And if you can figure out a way to make Joe Manchin feel like he's special and can still, you know, tell his constituents, I'm my own guy. There's an opportunity here, and it'll be interesting, because the Republicans certainly aren't, you know, they have basically ceded all of this ground, and they're just basically going to spend it, I think, on these cultural aggrievements immigration and the xenophobia. Constrict voting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. We know what they're going to do. I don't think there's any doubt. They are not going to participate in governance other than to, you know, I mean, they'll blow a bunch of smoke and they'll stand up and scream about spending or whatever, but they're not devoting that kind of energy to this. Barely. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, I mean, they're not engaging, really. I mean, if you look at their media, what they're talking about in the midst of a $1.9 trillion bill just being signed, I mean, that's going to the poor and the middle class, and they are just, you know, basically whiffing on the whole thing. So I don't think that they intend to do that. And it's even possible on the infrastructure bill, if it comes in big, you know, I think the battle is still going to be with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and maybe some other of the, you know, so-called fiscal conservative Democrats rather than the Republicans. I mean, there may be a few who want to engage, but I kind of doubt it. I think that this is still going to be an internecine issue within the Democratic Party to do infrastructure. So, you know, this is, you know, we'll see. I mean, I don't know. I can't tell the future, but I can tell that right now we're in a different moment than anything I've observed over the last 30 years of watching this, you know, since the Reagan Revolution. It's shifted. It's different now. And it's not just Donald Trump. It's as you pointed out, there are a number of interlocking different phenomena that have happened over the past, you know, over the past 20 years anyway, of the progressive movement building, the Republicans just moving into a completely alternate universe. The media environment is completely different. And you have a politician like Joe Biden who doesn't seem to be activating the, you know, the same sort of racist, you know, button pushing that someone like Obama did. And for whatever reason, that combination seems to offer us a possibility here of doing something. I mean, I don't want to get too kumbaya because God knows, you know, we can be disappointed by virtually everybody in politics on one level or another. But it does seem to me that there's a possibility here that I would not have anticipated, honestly, just a few years ago, that we could be in this moment. But, you know, look where we are, 525,000, you know, people dead. So, yeah, that's a new thing.
Well, we will check in again with you next week, Heather, and we'll see where we're at. Folks can always read you in Salon.com and, of course, at your Uber blog, Hullabaloo, under the pen name Digby. Heather Parton, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and the popular blog, Hullabaloo. Now I'm going to hand the show over to our new Ring of Fire co-host, Emma Vigeland.
Thanks, Sam. Hello, everyone. I'm here with Ryan Cooper, who is the national correspondent at The Week. He recently wrote a piece called How Democrats Learned to Stop Worrying and Hand Out Fat Sacks of Cash, which I love. Ryan is one of the best. He always has his finger on the pulse of everything from a progressive perspective, in my view. So definitely check out his work at The Week. How are you today, Ryan?
I'm doing pretty well. Sorry, that was my cat right there.
Oh, well, you know, look, love cats, love dogs. And we're all working through some difficulties. You're working through feline difficulties. I just had about 20, 30 minutes of technical difficulties. People who watch or listen to this program know Sam usually will yell in those instances or get visibly frustrated. I just internalize it and get quite anxious. So thanks for working through that with me, Ryan.
My pleasure. It's happened to us all.
Yes, as such is the time. So I wanted to get into your piece because I've been fascinated by the contrast between the response to the economic collapse in, obviously, 2008, but then 2009 when Obama took office and Democrats controlled the House and the Senate with a much wider margin than they do right now, and the fact that trillion was a dirty word, basically, in terms of stimulus. And there was all the talk about how we can't go too big. Larry Summers was in the picture. You can't go over this number. And it kept getting whittled down, even though Democrats ostensibly had more power. Now, Democrats have the thinnest margin possible in the Senate, 50-50, with Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker, and an even smaller margin in the House. And this stimulus package, a lot of us are focused on what isn't in it, which is the $15 minimum wage, which is extremely important. But there's a lot of great stuff in it. So I wanted to, one, have you address that contrast, and two, talk about what your thoughts are about what the American Rescue Package contains.
Yeah, so Obama's new book that just came out a couple of months ago is kind of interesting on this question because, yeah, as you say, they had a huge majority in the Senate and a huge majority in the House. And, you know, historic Black president who is taking power. Let's not forget also that George W. Bush, you know, was leaving office with like 22% approval rating. I mean, he was just despised. There was massive, you know, momentum to do something. And yet in the key discussion in the White House, he writes about this, where they're talking about the size of the stimulus. Rahm Emanuel, according to Obama, at least, Rahm Emanuel says, you'll never get, you know, this more than 700 billion, you know, some number. You'll never get more than a trillion. And then Obama turns to Biden and Biden says, yeah, probably not. And then they're like, that's it. They don't even try to make the stimulus as big as their own economists think it should be. You know, and this is already after a negotiation internally within the economics team, where basically Larry Summers had buffaloed Christy Romer into cutting her estimate from 1.8 trillion to 1.2 trillion for inexplicable reasons. And so, you know, they basically were sitting on their own hands, you know, and pretending that they couldn't, you know, do much of anything. And in fact, you know, over and above that, there are a lot of clever tricks you could have used to increase the effectiveness of the stimulus without increasing the dollar amount. They're complicated. Don't need to go into them, but like the administration rejected all of them out of hand. And so now I think what's happened is they're making the opposite political calculation. You know, they hemmed themselves in politically by thinking that, you know, we're going to, you know, we're going to pay a price with the voters if we blow the deficit up. Like all the serious reporters in Washington, D.C. are going to be on our case if we, you know, are super aggressive, whatever. Now, you know, we're coming off a decade in which, you know, the deficit has exploded and yet the borrowing costs as a percentage of GDP are basically still at historic lows. You know, Obama did all this austerity and cut the budget deficit. Now Trump's come into office. After Trump came into office, what did he do? He cut taxes on the rich and gave it all to them. You know, all that hard work, you know, in this form of high unemployment for an entire presidency, basically. It was completely pointless. And I think that even the moderate Democrats are thinking like, what are we doing with this nonsense about, you know, negotiating with ourselves? You still see embers of it, as you said, in the bill, you know, when they sort of nipped away at it. But like fundamentally, the overall headline package is 1.9 trillion, more than twice as big in dollar amounts, and coming on top of an economy that is a lot stronger than it was in 2009. So it could be a real boom. I'm you know, fingers crossed. To get rid of the pandemic in the second half of this year. So yeah, what's in this thing? You've got $1,400 checks, and they did cut that down. About 17 million people, 12 million adults and 5 million children won't get partial checks because the phase out is steeper. That was stupid and pointless. The Senate moderates wanted that. But adult dependents now qualify. And so there's actually, I think, 26 million estimated adult dependents will get the $1,400 checks. So that's more than the previous number. And also, they didn't get anything in the previous rounds of checks, the $1,200 and the $600. So there's that in there.
And we should just say quickly, roughly 280 million Americans. You may have just said that, but I'm trying to dissect all of the data here. That's a significant portion. They are going to be getting that check.
Yeah, like 85%. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, then there's a bunch of money for vaccines. You know, got that rollout seems to be going quite well. Then there's a big expansion of the child tax credit, which I think this is ideologically the most important thing that's happened. They got rid of the phase out. The child tax credit used to have a phase out in which, in order to get it, in order to claim it on your taxes, you had to earn money. You know, so if you had zero income, zero labor income, you wouldn't get anything. And it would phase in, you know, with each new dollar earned, and then phase out once you made a certain amount of money. So it made like a trapezoid shape. Well, it got rid of the left side of the trapezoid. And that's really important because now it goes to the poorest people in the country, assuming they can implement it well. You know, certainly some people will be left out. We can talk about that. But fundamentally, you know, this reflects a conception of poverty that is totally different from what Democrats have been talking about for the last 40 years, which is to say that poverty is a lack of money, and you solve it by giving people money. And this, you know, all the things taken together should cut the poverty rate by about half. Urban Institute study said it's going to cut the child poverty. Let's see,
I think it was the church. Columbia said the child poverty rate by one third, if I recall correctly.
Child poverty rate will fall by a half. The overall poverty rate will fall by about a third.
Oh, so I was wrong. There we go. Thank you for correcting me there.
Urban Institute says 42% poverty rate fall for Black people, non-Hispanic people, 39% for Hispanic people, and 34% for white non-Hispanic people. So a huge fall in poverty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, some of this stuff will expire, the child tax credit, you know, which is just because they couldn't get it through the reconciliation package, but they want to make it permanent. And there's no reason why they shouldn't. It wouldn't be that expensive, only like $100 billion a year. And in that case, you know, it's like they've made what amounts to a child allowance, classic Nordic social democratic style child allowance, and just made it into this jerry-rigged tax credit thing that goes through the IRS. It's like an advanced tax credit.
Because Democrats can't give people payments, they have to make it sound as convoluted as possible and make it into a tax credit.
Yeah, exactly. And the, you know, I mean, now it's going to be coming in the monthly in the form of direct payments to individuals, just like the stimulus checks. But now, you know, Mitt Romney proposed a child allowance. And I think now there's going to be a real push on just grounds of simple technocratic competence to make it work efficiently, so you don't leave a lot of people out. You know, there are a lot of non-filers among the very poor, people who don't file their taxes, and maybe hard to track those people down. Certainly some of them will be left out. If you did it through the Social Security Administration, much more logical way. But that's implementation.
That was Romney's proposal, which even progressives were saying was a more efficient way to do this. And it just kind of, it played into the Republicans, oh, the IRS is good for nothing narrative. That's why Romney went with it. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, it's not really, doesn't have anything to do with taxes per se. You know, if you're talking about a child allowance, except maybe in terms of how you're going to pay for it or whatever. But you know, from what I've heard from Senate staffers, they were convinced by Matt Brunig's Family Fun Pack argument that you should just have, you know, give the checks out to everyone. And then whatever means test you want to do, and so rich people don't benefit too much, you just do it on the back end with taxes for each year. And so, you know, it's like centrists always talk about how they're, you know, we want to have efficiency. We don't want to have a lot of bureaucratic red tape. Well, what's more bureaucratic than trying to base a monthly benefit on annual characteristics that you don't even know until the end of the year? So, like, you know, it's metaphysically impossible. But that, again, is just implementation. Ideologically, we have jumped over the social democratic, you know, hurdle. The answer to poverty is give people money. And like now we're just quibbling over the details of it. And that is very encouraging.
Yeah. So, I mean, we covered so much there, and we didn't even get to the, you know, other parts of the bill that are key, right? So while you mentioned the adult dependents, obviously the continuation of the $300 a month unemployment through September, even though it was cut down again by moderates from $400 in the House version. But the tax credit is so key because we've been talking about this on the show. We're just discussing future implementation of the tax credit, even though that doesn't necessarily have to be the case right after the pandemic is over, I guess, and next fiscal year, they don't need to continue this program in the same way. But I think your sense of it is, and my sense of it is, it's like when you implement Social Security and Medicare or the NHS in the UK, once these programs are put in place that help people, it's very hard to roll them back. So, I mean, the hardest thing was getting this in the relief package to begin with, these kinds of programs. Can you talk about your view on how this might be sustained past the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, you're right. There is a ton of literature on how these type of welfare state programs are sticky. You know, there's a common meme that goes around the left that like the Nordic welfare states have all been like torn up, you know, since the 70s and the neoliberal turn. And the, you know, the Nordics did get somewhat neoliberalized to varying degrees, particularly Sweden in the form of, you know, giving up all of its state ownership of capital, but the welfare state has been expanded since the 70s in every single Nordic country, and even in the U.S. You know, it's just a handful of countries that have actually cut overall net welfare spending. And I think once people get, you know, a good handle on these checks, and they'll come to expect them, you know, it'll be a push to, like, you know, why would you stop doing this? It's so helpful to people who need help the most, and that indeed, you know, from people like Michael Bennett and Mitt Romney, to his credit, that is their intention. You know, they are going to try to do this permanently. And, you know, if you can do it once, why would you, you know, I mean, this doesn't really have anything to do with the pandemic per se. I mean, it helps people who are hurt by the pandemic, but, you know, it's just a hole in the welfare state that's been there forever. So why don't you just do it permanently and earn yourself, you know, some votes and, you know, help people who need it. And, you know, the logic of that's very compelling.
I agree. It's just the Republicans are going to fight it tooth and nail. And in the past, as you highlighted in the piece, that kind of why not thinking would not work. I mean, the fear of Republicans punishing them for spending too much was looming over all of these Democrats' heads. And I think you had a great line here. So you said, I can't believe I'm writing this, but it seems Democrats learned from their mistakes. And I can't believe I'm hearing that either or experiencing this, especially given what you contrasted with the recession and the response to it. So please just touch a little bit more on that contrast too, and just also how this bill, I'll read a few more things that are in it. But there is $50 billion in rental assistance, $30.5 billion for transit agencies, $200 million for Amtrak, $500 million for homeless relief. Not really much money at all for businesses like we saw in the first package of COVID relief. Can you talk about, one, the contrast and expand on the contrast between what we saw in the response to the recession and then also what we saw in response to the CARES Act as well, or in contrast to the CARES Act too?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and before I do that, one thing I wanted to mention, I forgot earlier, $86 billion bailout of like 180-something union pension funds that are about to go bankrupt. And so those have been made solvent for something like 30 years. Sherrod Brown's been pushing for that for a long time. And what this potentially augurs in, I think, is a totally different, you know, politics around policymaking, you know, as a sort of general matter. I mean, this is almost the worst nightmare of like capitalist ideologues, you know, like your Milton Friedman's and your Friedrich von Hayek's, where, you know, even Trump and you know, than the Democrats, at least some Democrats are basically competing as to who can bribe the citizens the most. You know, this is thought to be like, you know, ruin the economy or whatever, but it also tears up capitalist moral ideology. You know, the moral framework of capitalism is that the working class has to be like beaten into the labor market. You know, this comes from hundreds of years ago, that like in the, you know, early capitalism, this real demand for labor, we need to get these peasants off the land, we need to take their land away, we need to force them into the factories at threat of starvation so that they can work in the you know, mills or whatever. And that, you know, you still hear that kind of stuff from a lot of Republicans. You know, Lindsey Graham, I mean, the idea in the CARES Act that you could get, you know, $600 on top of your unemployment insurance. So if you're a minimum wage worker and you got laid off, you're making like double or even triple what your income was before. And that was horrifying, disgusting. You could see them like throwing up in the back of their mouths, the idea that people could be paid more not to work. And yet with something like, you know, getting rid of that side of the trapezoid, there's no phase in, all the people get it, even the people who don't work. And so you're getting rid of this disciplining function of you know, the policy structure. I mean, I think that if that keeps up, fingers crossed, not guaranteed, I mean, that could be totally revolutionary in terms of just like the basic structure of American society. It just making things, getting rid of so much horrible, pointless, you know, the bureaucracy that is all designed to horsewhip people in the labor market, all those work requirements and the you know, the incredible red tape that anybody has to have to get, like, you know, disability benefits and so on. It's like that. If we can do that, if we can do a child tax credit the right way, basically a child allowance, we ought to get rid of all that other stuff too. And just instead of saying, let's beat people into the labor market, we could say, let's coax them into the labor market with good benefits and high wages. That's how the Nordics do it. And they're more, a greater fraction of their population is employed than here. And it's like, you know, once you popped that, you know, top of, you know, basically welfare state subsidies, let's bribe the population. I think it will be hard to put that back in the bottle, basically.
Well, I mean, Republican politicians couldn't understand responding to financial incentives and doing what their donors tell them. If someone gives them money, they could never possibly understand that. So, I mean, that's a whole different rabbit hole, but I get this like latent feeling of, or I get this feeling of latent racism and bigotry when Nordic states are brought up, because you Republicans really just want to say, well, we're not like them, right? We don't have their population, but that's a whole different conversation, there. So the other point I want to touch on is, how amazing is it that Biden is presiding over this shift? Right? I mean, and it's not like he's doing so really actively, in my view. Sam always likes to say he likes to place himself at the center of where the Democratic Party orthodoxy is at any given moment in history. But the Democratic Party orthodoxy is here right now. And as you said, they may have learned their lesson. How much is that attributed to, you know, the movements of the past 12 years, but specifically, really, I think the last two presidential runs of Bernie Sanders and the organizing that has been put in place after that? And you know, there's a lot of cynicism and kind of muscle memory trauma among the left. Oh, the Democratic Party isn't responding to us. But in my view, if we're being intellectually honest, this kind of package is not just a response to the failure of the Obama administration to recover the economy in an appropriate time, which was then used against him by Republicans, and then the historic losses of over 1,000 seats during his tenure. Although I think that's a majority of it. I think part of it, too, is there was some penetration of leftist ideology into the orthodoxy. Do you see that Biden has responded to that? And do you see that the Democratic Party as a whole has responded to that in at least some way?
Yeah, I think definitely you don't get this bill without Bernie's two runs. you know, I think that his first run really cracked the confidence of the sort of neoliberal establishment. You know, it showed that Hillary Clinton had this huge glass jaw, and the politics of Clintonite triangulation really was, there's just didn't have an audience anymore. And then she went down to Trump. And people forget this. Bernie almost had it. He was so close. Even the 538 dorks said that he was, you know, he was had a, you know, 4 in 5 chance for a couple weeks there. And then everything broke for Biden all at the same time, like one weekend, and that was it. But I think what, you know, people saw how he caught fire and how his credibility and his messaging was really turning on the people who the Democrats need, you know, like the working class and minority voters, you know, especially young people above all. And I think also, you know, aside from just like sensing political advantage, there has been a ton of, you know, argumentation, ideological moving. I mean, just the, if you remember the austerity frenzy in 2010, I mean, the whole political establishment was just champing at the bit to cut. And that was,
and let me just quickly say, and backed up by the media as well. And now the media is pretty dismissive of Republicans, given what Trump has done. I mean, I think that was the service Trump provided, right? Is he got the media to be pretty pissed at Republicans and not giving them deference like they normally did.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it was maybe also one too many times of, doing the deficit trick. You know, it was like Clinton cut the deficit, George Bush gave all the money to rich people. Obama cut the deficit, Trump gave all the money to rich people. And now it's like, you know, the national debt is so high, and yet it's causing no problems whatsoever. The interest rates are rock bottom, you know, and a lot of people are like, well, what are we, you know, why are we bothering with this? And, you know, within economics in particular, the economics discipline is almost unrecognizable compared to how it was in like 2013, 2014 even. There's been a real penetration of kind of lefty thinking on monopolies, on debt and interest rates, the minimum wage. You know, that the consensus on that is completely flipped in a decade. It used to be economics was totally convinced that a high minimum wage lose jobs, but people just put study after study after study actually looking at it, and it doesn't. You know, at least in the ranges of people commonly discuss. And now the consensus is, according to, you know, like surveys of the profession, now $15 is fine. And we didn't get that one, but, you know, Biden supported it and he did try to put it in the package. It was just the Senate moderates, you know, Kristen Sinema and Manchin, et cetera. But yeah, so it's like on a many fronts, you know, politically ideologically, culturally, in the media, the left has been winning some fairly significant victories. And it's just so surprising that, you know, Biden, who was like the worst member of the field, you know, had the most conservative record on anti-integration, on, you know, the war on crime and drugs, austerity, credit card companies, bankruptcy reforms, so many horrible decisions. And yet here he is, you know, he's just basically a vector of the party, and the party's energy for the moment, at least, is say, yeah, big spending, New Deal stuff. Let's bring it back. Roosevelt's good again, baby. Wolf howl. And, you know, we love to see it.
We love to see it, as the kids say. Yes, it feels odd to be kind of speaking in this way about actions done by the Democratic Party now that they're in power. But we're here to call it like we see it. And this is a very good stimulus package, in my view. So Ryan Cooper, national correspondent for The Week, his latest piece, or I'm sorry, you've just wrote a piece called What Does Joe Manchin Really Want? But the piece we discussed today, How Democrats Learn to Stop Worrying and hand out fat stacks of cash. Ryan, where can people learn more about your work and read your work?
Yeah, find me at The Week or my, Twitter at Ryan L. Cooper. And also I have a podcast called Left Anchor. So more content than you probably would care to actually consume.
Yes, Ryan's one of the best. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com and support this show by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm, my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day and featuring an in-depth interview like two or three times a week, ladies and gentlemen. For Emma Vigeland, Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.